You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about an effort to bring a historic airplane back home to Wisconsin.
First, Governor Walker proposed a new self-insurance plan for state workers earlier this year. Under a self-insurance system, the state would no longer be purchasing insurance from 18 HMOs. Instead, it would contract 6 insurance companies to administer the program, while the state would assume the risks currently handled by private insurers.
Walker said the self-insurance plan would save Wisconsin money, but it came under harsh criticism from the State Budget Committee yesterday. David Wahlberg covered the talks on the state capitol yesterday and joins us now. He's a health reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. David, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
What were the biggest concerns raised by the Budget Committee when it comes to self-insurance?
Well, there were several things that they talked about. One is about whether self-insurance would actually save the state $60 million over the coming 2 years, which has been questioned for quite a long time. And there's different consultant figures that have come out saying that this move may save money or it could potentially cost money. So that was sort of a renewed visit to that issue. But then a couple of other things came up. One is a question of whether local governments, which some local governments and school districts are part of the state worker health plan today, and there was a question of whether that could still happen under self-insurance. And then there was also some questions about whether benefits might change.
Give us some self-insurance 101. If this switch were to be made, what would it mean for how the state provides health coverage for employees?
Sure. So currently the state, for the roughly 250,000 state workers and some of these local workers and their family members, the state pays premiums to 18 different health plans, 17 of which are fully insured health plans. Basically the health insurance companies take on the risk for claims. Under self-insurance, the state would pay for these things directly, though the state would hire 6 vendors to sort of administer the program. But the state would be on the hook for large claims, for example, organ transplants or premature babies or things like that that can be really expensive.
And what's the case to be made that this would save money? What are we hearing from Governor Walker and his administration?
Well, and this came out in a little bit more detail with the Joint Finance Committee. So it's sort of two ways. One is basically the administrative costs you save on not giving the health insurance companies that money to accept the risk and sort of run the program. And so the state might save some money that way. And then the other way is by sort of reducing the number of insurance companies that are involved, so going from 18 to about 6. But what became more clear yesterday, though it had been talked about before, is that the state really plans to reduce that insurance company number from 18 to 6, whether or not the self-insurance part of it happens.
Right. That was news to me. I hadn't caught that part of this plan. So even without self-insurance, they're planning to cut down the number of insurers.
They are. And they basically said roughly 2/3 of the savings comes from that. So, more than half of the savings could be achieved without going to self-insurance.
How would all of this affect the coverage that state workers get? Would they notice a big change?
Well, that's a big question. The Department of Employee Trust Funds is saying no, they wouldn't. That's 98% of providers, meaning doctors and clinics, that are currently in the program would remain. So just a few would be gone. It came out yesterday that there's a slightly larger percentage of patients that would have to shift doctors. I think they said it was closer to 4%. And in terms of whether the state might reduce benefits or increase copays or things. As I've said before, that can happen whether or not it's under self-insurance. That could happen today. That could have happened. That did happen a couple of years ago. And so that could happen next year, regardless of what happens with self-insurance.
Talking to David Wahlberg, health reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at self-insurance. It's the way the state would cover state employees for health care in the governor's budget. It's up before the legislature now, went before the Joint Finance Committee for some early questions anyway. David Wahlberg from the Wisconsin State Journal covering this issue. David, that idea of cost and risk, was risk a concern for members of the legislature talking about this?
Yeah, that was a big theme that came up yesterday. So as I mentioned, you know, the state would take on the risk under self-insurance if there are big claims, unexpected big claims in a particular year. That might mean the state could have to dive into the reserves and pay that off. And several legislators expressed concern about that. The flip side, of course, is that on other years when there aren't large claims, then the state could make money or save money that they're currently giving to these insurance companies. And in terms of context on that, you know, most large employers of this size do self-insure because the pools are considered large enough that the risk isn't great. Now, a related issue that came up yesterday, as before, is whether the state would want to have sort of a stopgap insurance to prepare for some of these unexpectedly large claims. But that itself is kind of costly, several million dollars a year, and so the consultants were saying it's not really worth it.
And the part of this law that would lower, as you said, the number of insurance providers from 18 to 6, regardless of whether self-insurance happens, was there a reaction to that on Joint Finance?
Well, Representative John Nygren, who's one of the co-chairs of the committee, certainly was not happy about that. Somebody from ETF kind of explained that that could happen regardless of what the Joint Finance Committee decides about self-insurance, meaning that the Group Insurance Board, which oversees state worker benefits, could and indeed plans to do this regionalization of health plans regardless of the self-insurance decision. And so Nygren, you know, said, you know, you're telling us that what we say doesn't matter and that doesn't make us very happy. This is connected to an effort that the legislature made a couple of years ago to have complete oversight over this, any changes to state worker benefits. And Governor Walker vetoed that in his budget, and the Finance Committee ended up getting sort of partial oversight over just the self-insurance portion of this.
And let's look at that local issue you mentioned earlier, the idea that local governments would be caught up in this, and maybe they can't go to self-insurance because of a state attorney general's opinion back in the 1980s.
Right. So there was a ruling back then that basically said the state can't create an obligation on the part of the state to pay the debt of another. So in this case, the other would be local governments or school districts. So that is what the Legislative Council mentioned last week, that this might prevent the local governments who currently participate in the state worker health plan from being able to be self-insured through the plan. And Representative Nygren mentioned something about another ruling coming out soon that might agree with the AG's opinion. I'm not sure what he was referring to. But the Employee Trust Funds administrator there yesterday said that their attorney disagrees that this AG ruling from the 80s was really about a tangential issue and that they believe they could self-insure local governments through the program too. But if for some reason that isn't the case, they said they could just do local governments could remain insured the way they are today with the larger pool of the state workers shifting to self-insurance.
We'll leave it there, David. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me.
That was David Wahlberg, health reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to take a look at opposition to Governor Walker's self-insurance proposal for state workers that was at the Capitol yesterday.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear about a historic passenger aircraft that may be coming back to Wisconsin nearly 50 years after it left the state.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Vata Adari always loved chocolate, and reading about it and experimenting with chocolate became a refuge for her from her work as a successful criminal defense attorney.
At the time, as a youth, I had no interest in being a part of the system because I couldn't believe how flawed it was. I thought lawyers are part of the problem too. So I had no interest in being any part of that. I thought, I'm going to be an activist. I'm going to be doing something in some other capacity to make change happen. I was working for the Fair Housing Council here in Madison. I was a complaint analyst. I was doing a lot of the work that our panel of lawyers I thought should be doing, and I was getting paid $7 an hour. So I decided I should just go to law school. It's only 3 years. You know, when you're out there as a grown-up in the working world, you got to think about, okay, how do I make a living? And can I make a living and still pursue these goals? And so I thought, okay, being a criminal defense attorney, you know, I can do that. I was definitely put through a lot as a young attorney, and I always looked younger than I was. And being a woman of color attorney also. I remember times where, you know, it might be my fifth or sixth time in a courtroom, and the deputies knew damn well who I was, and they would say, where's your lawyer? First of all, I've always loved chocolate, dark chocolate. So I was always experimenting with different foods, and I decided 1 year I was going to do all of the confections. I wanted to make a saffron bonbon or a saffron truffle. Those were like a big hit, so that kind of became my thing. And then when I moved on, you know, I would do it just for gifting to family and friends. And then I just became, you know, I don't think anybody realized I was, you know, that was like my refuge, right? And that's what I would do when I wasn't doing research on my cases. I would research chocolate and the science of chocolate. From Kansas, I moved to Washington, and from Washington, I moved back here about 3 years ago. And I left the government. I left the federal defender system and started my practice back up here. And I haven't, even though I'm from Madison and I have a lot of roots here, I've never practiced here. And Madison, sadly, is a very good old boy place, as progressive as it purports to be. I had trouble establishing myself here as an attorney. I've got two kids. I'm a single mom. So I'm coming back here now as a grown up. And it's very difficult to leave government work, you know, or to leave a job. And in some ways, I think that's what attracts people to my chocolate is it's kind of the story of taking that risk, you know, and getting out of something that, you know, as much as I love practicing law, it is very grinding. Mm-hmm. Trial lawyers we have one of the highest suicide rates. We have one of the highest substance abuse rates. We have one of the highest rates of depression. We have one of the highest rates of miscarriage, divorce. I mean, you name it. I look at this and I just thought more and more, I don't want that. I was doing the chocolate to kind of fill time. So I'd go to the courthouse with like a briefcase full of chocolate. And my intention was actually to use it to get referrals. So I thought, well, maybe I can cultivate referral sources by giving people really good sweets. But then people started wanting the chocolate, you know? So I stopped taking cases. I still will take a few, you know, if they're local, but I'm being much more selfish with my time. You know, I think my personality is such that when I commit something and I get into it, I just don't stop. And that's what makes me a good trial lawyer, too. So with the chocolate, I can't stop doing it. You know, the chocolate is my refuge, and I own it.
Vata Adari is a lawyer and chocolatier in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, if you grew up in Wisconsin in the 1950s and 60s, you probably remember North Central Airlines. Maybe you even took a trip on one of their flights. Well, the airline flew into cities around Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and North Dakota.
One of the most iconic aircraft to fly for North Central was the Douglas DC-3 with the airline's mascot, Herman the Duck, painted on the tail. And now one of those planes may be coming back to Wisconsin.
John Helminiak joins us now. He's the executive director of the Aviation Heritage Center of Wisconsin in Sheboygan Falls and the founder of an exhibit on North Central Airlines. And he's currently in Arizona on his way to see one of the famed DC-3 planes. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, can you tell us how North Central Airlines got its start and what role it ended up playing in the aviation business?
Well, Wisconsin has a remarkable aviation history. And one of Wisconsin's great success stories in the commercial aviation world is North Central Airlines, which was founded in Clintonville, small town in central part of the state, in 1944 by the four-wheel drive company. Their executives needed a way to get quickly to Chicago and Milwaukee and back for meetings and business. And back then, in the 40s and late 30s, train service was ending, so the president of the company bought a couple of small aircraft and started flying his employees to Chicago and Milwaukee, and eventually other businessmen, no women at that time, primarily just businessmen in the 30s and 40s, said, hey, can we come along? And the president of four-wheel drive decided to start an airline because he saw demand for this service, and eventually they bought more aircraft, expanded their route system throughout the Great Lakes, moved their headquarters to Madison, and eventually to Minneapolis until they were bought by Republic Airlines in 1979. But it's a neat little small-town success story about an airline that, when it existed, really had a huge impact on aviation in the Great Lakes, because prior to North Central Airlines, if you lived in any of the small communities around the Midwest, your access to airline travel was minimal or non-existent until North Central came along and started serving some of those small communities like Yankton, South Dakota, or Ypsilanti, Michigan, or Clintonville or Manitowoc, Wisconsin, for that matter.
Yeah, why was the market able to sustain that kind of smaller town aircraft service then and not now?
Well, I think back then there was just less of it. The competition wasn't as great as it was now. And I also have to credit the DC-3 aircraft, which was extremely capable aircraft that could fly in virtually all weather conditions, provided the pilot made safe, proper weather-making decisions, as all pilots have to do today. But the aircraft could carry up to 24 passengers relatively economically and get in and out of small, even unimproved airstrips. So it could go to some of these small airports that maybe some of the other aircraft couldn't, and carry out a sizable passenger load, plus a lot of cargo. Airline travel really came into the mainstream of America because of the Douglas DC-3 aircraft. That was the first aircraft that the airlines looked at and said, we can carry a lot of people and a lot of cargo in this airplane and do it and make a profit, do it economically. So I think that's why North Central was able to do what maybe couldn't be done by others back then.
I was reading a little bit about this DC-3 plane you were talking about. You said it's a pretty trusty aircraft, but not as glamorous as we think of passenger air travel right now. The cabins were not pressurized, it sounds like, and there was no air conditioning.
Oh, my goodness, that's correct. If you talk to some of the flight attendants who flew on the DC-3, stewardesses, they called them back then, in the summer, the cabin would be extremely hot, and in the winter, it could often get very cold because the heating systems weren't that efficient on those aircraft. And if you speak with some of the former captains and co-pilots who flew those airplanes, they'll tell you that North Central Airlines actually issued them ponchos because in the summer, if they happened to be flying through a heavy rain, the cockpits leaked. It wouldn't soak the pilots, but they would get wet enough that North Central thought it would be helpful if they had ponchos. A lot different than it is now. The aircraft weren't pressurized, so they really never flew much above 10,000 feet, whereas today's commercial airliners are cruising at 33 to 36,000 feet typically. So they were a lot lower, a lot bumpier, and the climate conditions of the cabin was not always ideal.
As we mentioned, you're in Arizona. You're on the hunt for a particular one of these DC-3 planes that flew for North Central. Tell us about this plane.
When we started this commemorative exhibit to North Central Airlines, nobody else was doing it, and we thought that it's such a fascinating story, such a good Wisconsin aviation story that somebody ought to be commemorating that airline. And originally we thought, let's just find an aircraft that was the type North Central flew. And we settled on a DC-3 because, as we mentioned earlier, it's a very historic aircraft. And we would have been just happy to have one that didn't fly for the airline, that wasn't airworthy, just to put on static exhibit, painted in North Central Airlines colors, and let it sit outside at our museum. Then we got a call one day from an individual who said, I found an airplane for you, and you better be sitting down, because it's a DC-3, and it actually flew for North Central Airlines between 1954 and 1968. And the better news is that it's very, very close to being airworthy. It's in excellent condition. So we wanted that aircraft, managed to, in a very short amount of time, raise about $175,000 to buy that aircraft. We now own it. The former owner is thrilled that it's going to a museum in Wisconsin, back to its roots as North Central Airlines. In fact, the former owner is helping do a lot of the final maintenance that's needed to make it airworthy, and actually turned down offers of more money so we could have it. He wanted this airplane to be used as a North Central commemorative exhibit aircraft and hopefully be airworthy and continue to fly and give rides and tour around the Great Lakes and perhaps give folks an idea about what it was like to fly back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and also to share the history of North Central Airlines, which, if you're under the age of 45, you probably don't remember.
And so you found the plane. That's all good news. And just briefly as we wrap up, John, what needs to happen before this plane can come back to Wisconsin?
We need about $30,000 more to finish the final maintenance items, take it to Arizona where I am right now, and have it painted. We have a company here, Straubies Aircraft Services, who has agreed to paint it for us. They've arranged donations of paint. They're very enthused about the project. And then fly it back to Wisconsin. We're very, very close to reaching that amount, but we still need to get it. And if we do, hopefully the aircraft will be back in Wisconsin at Sheboygan County Memorial Airport and the Aviation Heritage Center of Wisconsin sometime this July, just before our air show on the third weekend of July. So that's the goal. That's the plan. We're keeping our fingers crossed. One of the most rewarding things, in summary, about this is doing this for the former employees of North Central Airlines, the stewardesses, the pilots, the mechanics, the baggage handlers, because for them, North Central Airlines was family. They started working.
John, we got to leave it there. Thank you so much, and good luck to you. That was John Helminiak, Executive Director of the Aviation Heritage Center in Sheboygan Falls, founder of an exhibit on North Central Airlines.
More coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, the first Republican effort since the election to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act fell short in the House last Friday. Speaker Paul Ryan canceled a vote on the bill because too many Republicans opposed it to get a majority.
I will not sugarcoat this. This is a disappointing day for us. Doing big things is hard. All of us. All of us, myself included, we will need time to reflect on how we got to this moment, what we could have done to do it better. But ultimately, this all kind of comes down to a choice. Are all of us willing to give a little to get something done?
President Trump and congressional Republicans have said this week that they're looking to come up with another plan. But the high-profile failure of the American Health Care Act has some Republicans casting blame on the president, his staff, Speaker Ryan, the Freedom Caucus, and moderate Republicans who oppose the bill.
Our next guest says there's a lot of blame to go around, but a lot of it goes, she says, to the president and his staff. She says we'll need to see a big change if the president wants to get things passed in Congress. Jennifer Rubin writes the Right Turn column at the Washington Post. I talked to her yesterday morning about the bill. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
When it comes to the Republican House health care bill, how much of the blame do you assign to President Trump in particular for it not coming to a vote?
I think he shares that blame with Speaker Ryan. After all, he is the president of the United States. He chose to, in essence, delegate this task almost entirely to Ryan. He never immersed himself in the details of the bill. He never figured out what it was that people objected to. He sort of presented it to his troops and said, this is it. Isn't it great? Sign up. It was a misunderstanding, I think, of how the legislative process works. And I think it's indicative of a certain style of business behavior that is not really going to translate all that well into politics.
Right. What we've heard about Donald Trump as a manager, it seems like he's a big picture, a large scale vision guy, and maybe delegates the finer points and details to other people. Is that a fair characterization, do you think?
It is, and he also, I think, sets up these competing sets of advisors and power centers, and those people tend to clash, they tend to confuse the process, they tend to send mixed signals, and all of that. Maybe it worked in some privately held real estate family business, but it really does not work in the White House.
Well, I wonder if this was an impossible task. When we look at the Republican caucus in the House, we've seen what happened to John Boehner. There's dissension within the ranks on a lot of issues. Could a different president or even this president with a different approach, different tactics, have actually gotten something through?
It would have taken a very long time. And the one thing we know Donald Trump doesn't have is patience and tenacity when it comes to the nitty-gritty of governance. I think you would have had to start just like President Obama did, frankly, on a 13-month journey that he started to bring his party together, to educate the public, to build support outside of Washington from insurers and hospitals and doctors. Donald Trump was not willing to do that, and frankly, Paul Ryan wasn't willing to do that. We don't know whether that would have worked. I think another approach that might have worked would have been to appeal to those moderates who ultimately held up the bill, try to peel off some Democrats and build a more centrist coalition. After all, Donald Trump did not run on cutting back benefits for people in rural areas. He ran on the opposite. He didn't run on a platform of let's make the rich richer, which the bill did through tax cuts. So if he had, I think, been a little bit more true to actually some of the themes of his own campaign and tried to take that, translate that into a coalition within Congress and out there in the country, it may have happened. But that's sort of like asking if an acrobat can play middle linebacker. These are two different things, two different tasks. And I'm not sure that Donald Trump, as I said, has the skill set to succeed in the kind of endeavor I described.
During the campaign, Trump had said day one, maybe we're going to start rolling on this. We're going to do it quick. We heard similar things from congressional leaders. Did that that need for speed get in the way?
Absolutely. And government does not move quickly. He also said a whole bunch of things. He was going to rip up the Iran deal on day one. He was going to do all sorts of things. He was going to build the wall on day one. Everything was going to happen on day one. And that's just not how government works. You don't bark out orders and everyone gets in line. He has to learn to deal with vast bureaucracies, a divided Republican Party. Democrats count, too, even though they don't have majorities in either house. The public counts. Governors, who, by the way, weighed in at a very propitious time against the bill, they count, too, because they have to manage what Washington sends them. So I think all of this should be a lesson that if you set expectations really high and don't meet them, it's really bad. Better to promise less, deliver more, and set people's expectation that this is going to be a process. You can begin tax reform. You can begin health care reform. But don't expect it to be over in 17 days.
What about the president's staff, his leadership in the White House, his leadership team in the White House? What should they have done differently in this process?
Perhaps they should have resigned because none of them really know what they're doing. I don't mean to be cruel, but these people have never served in the White House. They've never served in government, most of them. They have no idea how to construct complicated legislation, no idea how to put together a winning coalition. They're really in over their heads. And I think if the president wants to succeed, he's going to have to make room for or swap out staff, including some people who really know how to organize a White House and a government. This is not unprecedented, after all. President Clinton, who ultimately went on to have a lot of legislative achievements, if you remember, began with a chief of staff who was his kindergarten friend, Mac McClarty. That was a disaster for about a year, actually. He then brought in Leon Panetta, later defense secretary, later CIA chief for President Obama, and he really got the trains running on time. He was deeply experienced. He knew Congress. He had been a legislator. And I'm wondering if at some point he's going to need to turn to a Republican version of Leon Panetta, if there is such a person, and try to work building the blocks of a coherent, doable agenda.
Talking to Jennifer Rubin, she writes the Right Turn column for the Washington Post, looking at last week's failure to bring a health care plan to a vote and what comes next. And let's move to what comes next. Jennifer, what do Republicans do with health care, with Obamacare, the law of the land, now?
There seems to be some confusion, doesn't there? President Trump says he's going to wait for it to explode, or he's going to let it explode, and then he'll come back to it. He wants to move on because Donald Trump does not like the stench of defeat, and he can't get away from this fast enough. On the other hand, we hear voices from the Republicans in Congress who says, really, not so fast. Let's see if we can really get this right this time. That's probably the last thing that Donald Trump wants. So there is confusion and disagreement on the Republican side about whether they really want to abandon health care or not right now. The next thing that we had anticipated coming down the pike was tax reform. Tax reform is not easy under any circumstances, and the defeat on health care makes it more difficult in two respects. One, they were counting on some revenue generation from the health care bill. When you roll back benefits and you cut back on Medicaid, you save some money. So they were going to use that money, frankly, to pay for tax cuts. So in that respect, it's damaging. And secondly, of course, it's just a political defeat for the president. He looks less impressive, less powerful. Paul Ryan has generated less respect, less fear in his own caucus. So I'm not sure that tax reform is going to do it for them either. You now see there is some talk about moving back infrastructure building, which for a while had seemed to have been postponed till next year. That's very popular, particularly with some Democrats, but you have problems there, too. There are a lot of fiscal hawks on the Republican side who don't want to spend the money. Paul Ryan has suggested, and the White House has suggested, maybe we could do some public-private partnership, but that smells of tax cuts and tax incentives for rich real estate developers, so that's not going to be very politically popular. So these are big, complicated things. There's no surefire road to a quick win. Now, I think he had counted on Judge Gorsuch, who is the nominee, of course, for the Supreme Court to replace the late Antonin Scalia. They had counted on him being a quick victory. Now that the Republicans have decided that they're going to filibuster, there's a little bit of a hiccup there. It may force the Senate to change the rules and really get rid of the remnants of the filibuster with regard to nominees. But that's not a clear path quite yet. I think he will get Gorsuch, but that may take longer than he anticipated.
We had a call-in about the health care bill after it didn't come to a vote, and we had callers, liberals and conservatives, self-identified, saying what needs to happen next is both parties need to come together. Democrats need to accept that, hey, there are going to be changes to Obamacare. Republicans, that Obamacare is going to stick around, though they need to fix it, compromise, go back and forth, change things. That shouldn't sound like a crazy pie-in-the-sky idea, is it?
It does not sound like a crazy pie-in-the-sky idea. I myself have suggested that, but I just don't think the Republicans are ready for it. They still have it in their minds that Obamacare has to be ripped up by the roots. It's unfixable. They can't have it. It has become just an article of faith in the way that abortion rights have become an article of faith on the left and the pro-life movement has become an article of faith on the right. They simply can't get themselves there. So I think the most logical path, which would be to work on some reforms that Democrats acknowledge need to be made, that simply does not seem to be available because Republicans are simply not willing to accept that.
I want to talk about presidential leadership a little more. President Obama got criticized for, he liked doing the big public speeches. He got into the policy detail, but he wasn't necessarily good at that sort of diplomacy with Congress that presidents need to do. He didn't win them over on a personal level. Seems like we might be seeing some of that again. What would it take for an administration, Democratic or Republican, to build that diplomatic effort to Congress?
Well, it is a little bit of a Goldilocks situation. You want people who are good out there on the public. You also want people who are good one-on-one and who have the details. I think Donald Trump thought that simply because he brought people over to go bowling at the White House and he said a nice word or two about them, that that would mean that they would vote for him. And it's surprising perhaps to him, but lawmakers actually care about the content of what they're voting for. They care about it from an ideological standpoint. They care about it because their constituents are affected by it. And simply because he doesn't have any fixed beliefs, all he cares is about getting something, doesn't mean that they do. And I think that is a rude awakening for him. He cannot simply tell them, if you don't vote for this, you're going to lose your seats, or if you do vote for this, you're going to be a hero back home. They actually want to know what's in it. And I think in this regard, that's a very big change in mindset that would be required for President Trump to be successful.
We'll leave it there for now. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was conservative columnist Jennifer Rubin. She writes the Right Turn column for The Washington Post.
Coming up, a question for you. Do you write letters? Are you a regular correspondent with your friends, your family, or your pen pals? Or did you used to write letters, but maybe you stopped in the age of email and social media? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take your calls about writing letters coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Letter writing used to be one of the main ways to stay in touch with people near and far. But in the age of email and social media, is it a dying art form?
We want to hear from you. Do you write letters? Are you a frequent correspondent with family or friends? Do you have a pen pal? Call 800-642-1234.
Or did you write letters once upon a time, but maybe you stopped? You don't do it anymore. And if so, what changed? Was it because of email, Facebook, or Snapchat? Is it the same to stay in touch online, or is it missing that personal connection? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And this comes from, I was at home at my folks' place helping them get rid of some stuff, and they had a tote of some of my old papers, and I looked, and it turned out in high school for a while, I wrote just a ton of letters and got a ton of letters from people I met at summer camp programs and things like that. I'd kind of forgotten about it. I don't know how anybody read anything I wrote. My handwriting was terrible then. It would be worse now, but it made me think I don't write letters at all now, really.
Yeah, I sense an epistolary memoir from Rob Ferret coming up. Oh, the early years, one volume of the memoir.
This is letters between teenagers. There's nothing in there that anybody's going to be interested in. I think I can promise you.
I used to write letters as well. I would get pretty stationary, and I used to love to write letters. I wrote to authors, too, authors I admire,
oh, cool.
And I have a collection of a few letters, anyway.
That you got back?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to our callers. A lot of people want to talk about this. Leela will start us off in Milwaukee. Leela, hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah, tell us, are you a letter writer?
I am, but mostly I do mine with coalition work. You know, I'm a big, avid fan of writing to my senators and congresspeople and other representatives when they're doing a good job or if I just need to let them know my opinion. So the reason I was calling, I have quite a collection. I have a suitcase full of love letters from my great-grandparents from before they got married.
Wow.
Which I just love opening those up and smelling the old paper. It's kind of like when you go into a bookstore. They all have that old book smell. My grandmother on my father's side, when she was in first grade, she got a pen pal in Amsterdam. And they were lifelong friends. Back in 83, we actually went to the Netherlands and stayed with them. And they were both friends until they both passed on. And that they were always writing letters to each other.
And is it entertaining or informative to go back and read the letters of your grandparents or great-grandparents?
It is. I just love it. It's one of my favorite things to do. It keeps me in touch with who they were as people, you know? And this year for my birthday, my mother actually gifted me with an envelope embosser. It has my home address on it so that I can emboss envelopes with a return address.
Cool. Leela, thank you so much for sharing that. That's great having that those mementos that tells the story of grandparents, great-grandparents, and others.
Right, they can mean a lot to future generations that you don't even think about. You know, maybe your kids are going to like to go through this. Have you let your children read these letters?
No, most of them, I recycled almost all of them.
Aww,
I gotta admit.
You should have kept them.
I read, you know, when you read biographies of famous people and you're like, wow, they wrote really profound stuff. And their letters. And I'm like, yeah, that new Depeche Mode song is really good. People don't need that. I better not become famous.
You don't know. You should have kept them. Leela, thank you so much for that. And let's go to Greg in Waukesha. Greg, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And thanks for having this topic on your show.
Oh, you're welcome.
I write letters, both handwritten and printed for paper. actual physical letters, and I think that they are still one of the best ways to keep privacy. You can't necessarily, unless you scan it, you can't write a letter and have it sent, broadcasted all over the world through the internet. So it is a privacy, that's one thing. The other is, people will look on those letters, and they can be very personal or very informative, and it's probably our best way of keeping record of our family. And what a gift to give your kids and grandkids. And I have letters from my great-grandfather and his family that goes back to the turn of the last century.
Oh, wow.
And finally, I'd like to just add this, that we have a real gem in Milwaukee. The oldest pen store in the United States, Daly's Pens, is in Milwaukee. And it's on North Avenue. It's run by and owned by a man named Brad Bodart. He's a real resource. And he also knows and sells Parker pens that were made in Janesville, Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
And in addition to pens, new and old, he sells stationery and notebooks. Huh.
Well, that's fantastic, Greg. So really, this is something that's been a part of your life and means a lot to you. Do you have a preferred pen and paper that you like to use when you're writing your letters?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of it depends upon who I'm writing the letter to, but I write with fountain pens, and so I use papers that are really made for writing with fountain pens.
Something to soak up the ink. Well, that's fantastic, Greg. Thank you for sharing that. Again, getting at the value of letters to future generations. Yeah. And also, I hear in Greg's voice, he loves doing this. It's something that means a lot to him.
I know some people are really into their pens and stationery. Kindred spirits with Greg. We'll go back to our callers. Karen is with us in Freedom. Karen, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you guys that a couple months ago, I received a letter in the mail requesting that I become a pen pal. And it was for my 7-year-old granddaughter. Aww. Who lives in Oshkosh.
And so you've been writing back and forth with her?
We have. It usually comes once every week to 10 days that we are able to pass letters back and forth. But she one-ups me because she's become quite the illustrator as well. So.
Fantastic, Karen. Thank you so much. What a great way to keep in touch. I think it's, you can Skype and whatever, but that letter's got to be something you look forward to in the mail.
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea, actually. And then also, the kid in question gets some practice writing and expressing themselves in the written word. So there's some learning that goes along with it there, too, along with the kind of the intimacy of the letter that just you and you alone are reading. That's a great, very cool idea, Karen. Thanks for that. And we go to Elizabeth next in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I do write letters, and I love receiving the letters. And the reason is just the personality of the person that I'm writing or who's writing me just comes shining through their penmanship and what kind of stationery they're using, if there's stickers, put on the envelopes, and also... this really shines through. My mother just passed away in January, and we were looking at some letters of hers, and just seeing her handwriting just brings back so much emotion. So I really, you just can't get that electronically.
I'm sorry you lost your mother, Elizabeth, but it's interesting to hear about how much seeing her handwriting means to you, and it sounds like that's something to keep in mind, having that record like that. Fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for that call. We heard from Roger on Facebook, who says he wrote to his wife for 4.5 years, then went to the Philippines, ultimately married her. Now they've been married for 16 years, have 3 kids, ages 13, 11, and 5, a happy family. And it all started, it sounds like, with this written correspondence.
Oh, well, there's obviously a lot here to talk about. Rob, are you going to start writing letters as a grown-up and not just a teenager?
I don't know. Again, it would take some work to make it readable. I mean, at this point, I think the CIA could encrypt communications by me having me print or try to do cursive with it.
Yeah, you have that little chicken scrawl, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't write letters.
Maybe. Should I write you a letter? I'll be away for a bit on this WPR
tour.
You should
write it. Write us a letter and we'll read it on the air.
And I'll decipher it for you when I come back.
Yeah, Dispatch from the Road with Rob Ferrant.
Thanks for all of your calls. You can keep sharing your thoughts on letter writing on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrant. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.